To the left-hand side for Vieira, who'll play it through to Gabriel Jesus, who's in here for Arsenal. Gabriel Jesus to finish it off. Oh, what a way to do it! Gabriel Jesus seals the points for Arsenal. He's back, and he's back with a bang.
Into the penalty area it goes. Gabriel header, and it's into the back of the net. Arsenal take an early lead through Gabriel.
You're listening to the Chronicles of Aguna, the daily Arsenal podcast with me, Harry Simeon.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Hope you're all good. Hope you're all well. Welcome back to another live edition of the Chronicles of Aguna, the Arsenal podcast, part of course, the 90 Min Football family with me, Harry Simeon. And on this episode, we're looking ahead to Arsenal's trip to the Amex Stadium, another must-win game for Mikel Arteta's side after Liverpool regained top spot, having beaten Sheffield United at Anfield last night. It was a weird one, that, because I went into the game with zero expectation of Sheffield United causing Liverpool a problem. I went into that game thinking it would be three, it would be four, maybe it'd be five, maybe even six. And I was actually quite worried about our goal difference and how Liverpool had the opportunity, obviously, to make a bit of a dent in that last night. In the end, in terms of the goal difference, the result wasn't a disaster for us. You know, it was a 3-1 win for Liverpool. So they made up plus two against an opponent that, you know, yeah, you'd expect them to wipe the floor with. We picked up plus two, of course, against Luton Town the other night. So, you know, we are as we were, and that's absolutely fine. But I'd be lying. I'd be lying if I said that when Conor Bradley scored an own goal after about an hour, I didn't start to believe, maybe just a little bit, that Liverpool were going to slip up or drop a couple of really, really valuable points. It was weird because at the time I was like, you know, the game started, it was 0-0 and everybody was texting me going, oh, hold on a minute, you know, Liverpool not looking too good in the first 15 minutes. And then there was the most calamitous of own goals. Well, it wasn't an own goal, but the most calamitous of mistakes that led to the ball ricocheting off of Darwin Nunez's block and going into the back of the net. And I thought, forget it. There's nothing here for us. Started watching the other game, which we'll talk about briefly in just a moment, and decided I was going to ignore the Liverpool game, turned off the notifications, everything. I didn't want to know. And then it came up on TNT Sports that Conor Bradley had scored an own goal and that Sheffield United were back on level terms. And a few mates were texting me saying, oh, you know, this could be something for us. And I'm sitting there going, no, Sheffield United aren't good enough. They're certainly not at the level required to get something from Anfield. Forget about it. Don't even get your hopes up. Don't get caught up in this stuff because it's only going to end one way. But as time went on, when we got to about 70 minutes, I thought, you know what, maybe. And then Alexis McAllister banged one into the top corner and all of that hope was gone. Thankfully, as I say, it was only 3-1. So the goal difference situation is still in our favour. We've still got plus 48 in comparison to Liverpool's plus 42. We're just 2 points behind them as they sit top of the table. Now, they go away to Manchester United this weekend. We, of course, take on Brighton and Hove Albion. Brighton is going to be a really, really tricky game. I'm certain of that. And we're going to talk about it on this podcast in detail, of course. Liverpool at Man United. Do I see there being something in it for United? Had they won last night, I might have said yes. You know, I looked at them last night, and although they went 2-0 down and they started the game really, really poorly, I thought to myself, you know what? They've shown a resilience to come back to 2-2, even though the first goal was gifted to them by Moises Caicedo. It's amazing what 100 million gets you in midfield these days. But Moises Caicedo gifted them a goal. They managed to fight their way back into the game. They made it 2-2 before the break. And you thought to yourself, you know what? There's a bit of life still in this Manchester United side. Then they come up with a third goal, and a player that I've been super critical of, Antony, put an unbelievable pass in for Garnacho, who, you know, I don't want to say it much, and I'll say it quietly because he's a Man United player, but I really, really rate Alejandro Garnacho. I think he's really, really good, really lethal in front of goal. He pops up with that header after the brilliant pass from Antony, and it's 3-2 to Man United, and you think they're going to see this out, you know, and what a confidence boost that would have been for Erik ten Hag's side, going into a game against a Liverpool team that they beat recently in the FA Cup, albeit in extra time. Now it's game on Sunday. And then Manchester United did what Manchester United have done this season under Erik ten Hag really, really frequently, which is press that self-destruct button and end up in a position where they've somehow lost that game. Is it going to be the end for ten Hag? You know, I'd be surprised if he's sacked between now and Sunday, but you do feel like this was a big moment in his Manchester United career. And what was really, really interesting about that game was it was so poor from both sides for most of the game. There was a few moments of brilliance because there was individual quality on the pitch, but generally it was such a bad game of football. And when Pochettino's side were 3-2 down and he was standing on the sidelines, you could kind of tell by his facial expressions that maybe he thought, this is the end of the road for me. And then for that to kind of flip sort of deep into stoppage time, and it then being Maurizio Pochettino jumping up and down like a madman in celebration because he knows that that was a big moment in terms of him keeping his job. And then the camera pans to Erik ten Hag. You think, wow, this is flipped. And now it's maybe Erik ten Hag who's standing there, you know, looking into the space, wondering what is going to come next. The really, really funny thing about Erik ten Hag for me is the way he refuses to ever sort of be critical of, you know, his team. He does say, yeah, you know, we could have done better here, we could have done better there, but it's always like, oh, well, we deserve to win the game. Who are you trying to kid here? Who are you trying to fool by, you know, constantly pulling for the, or reaching for the, well, we played okay for most of the game card? If you don't see the game out, it doesn't really matter, does it? And I think people will tolerate performances over results for a while at the beginning of a manager's tenure when he's trying to implement a new style. But the problem is for Manchester United is that they're quite far into this project now under Erik ten Hag. Nobody knows what their playing style is supposed to be. Nobody knows what the philosophy looks like. Nobody's got any confidence in his ability to take them forward. But what people seem to be pretty confident of and proven right almost weekly is that they do have a self-destruct button that they're more than willing to press. And the other thing with that is, you know, when you look at the results they have got, it's been down to the individual brilliance of a few players, which Manchester United and Chelsea, clubs of that wealth and that stature, are always going to have. So how much of that is down to the manager and how much of that is just down to having good, strong individual players in those attacking areas? So, yeah, I think it's probably going to be the beginning of the end for Erik ten Hag. As I say, I think he'll be the manager at the weekend and he'll be desperate to turn it around. And hopefully he can do that for us. Let's go over to the live chat. There's plenty of you with me at the moment. Don't forget, if you haven't done so already, please leave a like on the video. Subscribe to the channel as well if you're brand spanking new. Major Mad Bear says, I'm hoping that Wenger returns with his chef hat on to prepare the Liverpool squad a nice lasagna before the United game. We've got Bogdan, we've got James, we've got Halimi, we've got Sammy with us as well. Derek's here too. Thomas and Friends, aka Frankie, says, I refused to watch the Liverpool game. I turned it on at 75 minutes. Liverpool scored 30 seconds later. So it was your fault then. Why did you put it on? I purposely avoided it. Not that it made any difference in the end. He also goes on to say, you started the dream, Harry. We all did. Owen says, just have an awful feeling that Liverpool don't drop a single point for the rest of the season. I've been saying that, you know, I've been saying that and I've been killed for saying that. People have been sort of really going at me for suggesting that Liverpool have a much better run in than any of the other two sides in the title race. I don't think theirs is much worse than Manchester City's, by the way, on paper. But I just think Manchester City's involvement in the Champions League changes that. And makes it so that they have the slightly harder running because, of course, they have to navigate a couple of games against Real Madrid and potentially a first and second leg of a semi-final should they progress through that. Whereas Liverpool are in the Europa League, and I believe that the opposition they're up against in that competition is of the level that Liverpool can make some changes, can rotate, can freshen up. I'm not saying they can change their whole 11, but they can certainly change four or five players, a bit like we did against Luton the other night, keep it fresh, and still be very, very competitive. Halo says, no easy matches in the Premier League, both a comfort and a threat in that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What else have we got? Zed Tom says, that Chelsea versus Manchester United game was like two drunk clowns fighting. I love that. I love that. Okay, we are going to turn our attention to the mighty Arsenal, who take on, of course, Brighton and Hove Albion this weekend at the Amex Stadium. Kickoff's at 5:30 p.m. UK time. And the game is live, of course, on Sky Sports. It's also live on BBC Radio 5 Live if you'll be listening on the radio. I will be reporting on the game for BBC Radio London. So I'll be at the Amex from nice and early. I'm hoping, if possible, to maybe bring you guys some kind of podcast from the stadium after the game. But it depends on a couple of things. It depends on the result, if I'm going to be in the mood. It depends on the Wi-Fi as well, because some of these, although they might be state-of-the-art stadiums, the Wi-Fi is really, really poor. It's not strong enough to hold a live stream. What we will do if we can't do that is definitely bring you an episode on Sunday morning in which we'll break the game down in a lot more detail, of course. But if you're up for some instant reaction, then I'll try my best to bring you that. Also, a big thank you and a big shout out to everybody who's been following me on TikTok recently. I managed to hit 10,000 followers on TikTok the other day. And guess what? I haven't done a single dance or anything. It's just been football content. We've been taking clips from this podcast and distributing them on TikTok, as well as some standalone bits as well. So big thank you, because I know a lot of you that come here and watch the pod or listen to it have come over to there as well and given me a follow. So I really, really do appreciate that. Okay, let's kick off, I think, by looking at Mikel Arteta's press conference, which he gave earlier this morning. It was a 9 a.m. start for the Arsenal boss, nice and early. And it was perfect timing for me, because as I was making my coffee, I got the notification to say it was going to start. And I thought, happy days, I'll sit down, I'll have a listen, and we'll try and pick the bones off of what Mikel Arteta has to say. He was obviously asked the question about Bukayo Saka, and he said, we will know now. We have a training session in a few hours, and we will know whether he is fit or not. Everybody else seems okay. I'm convinced that Bukayo Saka is going to play at the weekend. I think the decision to leave him out against Luton completely was one that was done in order to make sure that he was available for tomorrow's game. So I'd be very, very surprised if Bukayo Saka isn't in the starting 11 when the team is named. Although Mikel Arteta, of course, trying to keep his cards close to his chest. There were lots of questions about the other night, about how happy he was on Wednesday after making some changes. He said, I was obviously very pleased with the result and the performance and the fact that everybody responded in the way we expected. When you make changes, there is a possibility, because they haven't played that much, that it doesn't go your way. But I think the boys were really, really good. And he's absolutely right. He was asked if our four away games are where the title will be won and lost. He refused to kind of pin it on the away games. He said, yes, but at home as well. We have the Champions League games and we have some big games at home. Every game in this league is extremely difficult. You look at last night, what happened again, and everybody is suffering to win because the level is so high. And we're going to have a really tough opponent again in Brighton. We know that. So we'll prepare and we'll try to be better than them to try and win. So Mikel Arteta not taking them lightly. Lots of questions about whether he was watching the games last night. He said he was watching a bit of both. And that's what those staggered kickoff times allow us to do. I know a lot of people are annoyed about it. Like, I was talking to a colleague yesterday and he said, oh, it's so crap that Man United and Chelsea kicks off at 8:15. And I said, yeah, if you're going to the game, it's not great. But if you're sitting at home on the sofa like me and you get to watch quite a bit of both of them as a result of the staggered kickoff times, I think it's quite good. Mikel Arteta was asked if he was watching in a Sheffield United shirt. I mean, is that a serious question? Anyway, Thomas Partey had been speaking after the Luton game and he said very clearly that his head is here, that he wants to be at Arsenal, that he's very happy to be here and that he wants to contribute. And the question pertaining to Thomas Partey's comments was put to Mikel Arteta in the press conference this morning. And he said he better have his head here because we are playing for big things and that's what we expect. We need him because he's a top player and a very important player for us. And you could see on the pitch the impact that he can have. He's our player. He's got one more year on his contract and I'm really happy with him. So Mikel Arteta Very, very pleased. Also very, very pleased with Kai Havertz, his contributions this season. What was interesting was that he said he doesn't think we've seen the best of him yet. He says that at his age, and given that he's just started with us, he's building those relationships. He's moving in those positions as well. And he's that good. And with the intelligence that he has, he can be much, much better. Lots of people have been making the point that Arsenal are a really strong, solid defensive unit at the moment. Mikel Arteta says he's proud about that, of course, because first of all, he talked about the team as organization in the defensive phase, and then the desire that the players have to keep clean sheets, defend well, and make it difficult for our opponents. That gives us a big platform. And on the weekend, that's going to be really important because they're a top side. What I think is really, really interesting about this is that when Mikel Arteta first came in at Arsenal, I think a lot of us gravitated towards him for a couple of reasons, maybe three reasons. First one being ex-Arsenal player, right? Ex-Arsenal player, there is already that affection. He captained the club for a little while. I have to say, when Arteta played for Arsenal, I didn't massively rate him. Like, I thought he was okay. I thought he could do a job. But he was doing a job in a side that was significantly worse than some of the sides that I'd grown up with. So for me to sit here and say now that I sort of fell in love with Mikel Arteta, the player at Arsenal, would be a lie. I think he was good. He was solid. He did a job for us, clearly got all the right attitude and all of the right ideas, as you can see that now, because he's become a manager and he's taken all of that on and been able to showcase that a little bit more by sort of implementing those values and making sure that they come through from the whole team rather than just displaying that as an individual. I think the other reason people quite liked him was because he sat down and he spoke quite openly and candidly about where the club were at that point. And all of us, I think, went, you know what? At least you can see what we can see. And that was a big boost, I think, in terms of people's faith and belief in him. When he was appointed, I kind of went, oh, you know, we'd been linked with Carlo Ancelotti at the time. And the Arteta appointment felt, I have to be honest, a little bit underwhelming at that point. But once he spoke, I was all in. And I did have my wobbles along the way. There were a couple of points where I thought, is this ever going to get better? He had the credit in the bank of winning the FA Cup as well. But what I think is really, really special about Mikel Arteta and why I'm, you know, backing him to go on and be one of the best coaches in world football is his ability to adapt. And at the start, maybe that wasn't clear. But this is a guy who's clearly taken all the difficult experience he's had in the early stages of his coaching career and shaped them into learns and turned them into valuable lessons from which he has learned and from which he has then gone on to think about the situation, think about where, you know, his team fell short in those particular moments and do everything within his power to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that's what really, really impresses me about this guy. We talk about the Pep Guardiola philosophy. You know, you don't really need to defend because you never give up possession. You're always high up the pitch, et cetera, et cetera. Mikel Arteta is not the same as Guardiola. He's not. And it feels like this season he's had his number a couple of times now, Guardiola's that is, because he's been willing to compromise on his values. Maybe not the core values and the core principles, but he's been willing to compromise on his style of play in order to deal with problems that he's faced in the past. That, for me, is the best type of manager. Have your core philosophy. Have your ideology. Yes. But you can't be arrogant enough to think that you'll be able to play your way every week against every opponent and that it'll always work. And there's never any room for a little bit of adaptation. And there's never any room to maybe just mold things a little bit differently. That's what I've loved about Mikel Arteta this season. Because if we want to play the swashbuckling football and take the handbrake off, as Arsene Wenger used to say, and go all out, we seem to be able to do that. But if we need to dig in, if we need to be smarter, if we need to show that streetwise side, we seem to be able to do that as well. And that is what I love about Arsenal this season and Mikel Arteta's evolution as a manager. I'm really, really enjoying it. And he talked about the fact that he's taken things from, you know, David Moyes, from Pep Guardiola, who he worked with, from Arsene Wenger as well in the past. And it feels like he's taken all the best components of each of those guys and created his own style and his own brand. And it seems to be working at the moment. Rob Edwards, of course, was very, very complimentary of Arsenal after the game the other night. He was complimentary in the build-up to the game as well. Rob Edwards is just a bloody nice guy. But he did say after the game that Arsenal have no weaknesses, and Mikel Arteta's response to that was as you'd expect. He said, "I see them. Managers probably see them all the time, but we don't. Let me rephrase that. The way it's worded is a little bit strange. Managers probably see what we don't have rather than what we actually have, but it's good to hear from other managers what they think about the team. We can still evolve a lot and we'll try to do that." And the follow-up question, as you'd expect, was what are those areas of weakness? What are those areas in which Arsenal could improve? And Mikel said, "I cannot tell you this, but I think we have many areas." So he's not resting on his laurels. He's not taking his foot off the gas, not for a second. I beg your pardon. I don't know where that sneeze came from. It just caught up on me. Okay, let's turn our attention to the statistics around this game. We'll take a look at Brighton's season so far. We'll talk a little bit about what we can expect from them as well. And then we're going to turn our attention to Arsenal's side, how I'd like us to play, the 11 I'd like us to go with. I'll also share a prediction. I was spot on with my prediction of 2-0 against Luton. Put a bet on it this time. No, I'm joking. I don't want to be responsible for anybody losing any money, not even a pound. Anyway, short pause and we'll be back with some statistics. Okay, let's head over to the Premier League's official website and take a look at some of the stats surrounding this game ahead of the kickoff, which is just over, well, I'm trying to calculate it. If 5:30 is 24 hours, then we're, 36 odd hours, whatever it is. I don't know. My maths is terrible on the spot trying to do that. Should never have fallen into that trap. Let's have a look at the head-to-head between these two sides. 13 Premier League meetings between the two. 5 wins apiece and 3 draws. So Arsenal have not had it all their own way when it comes to Premier League clashes with Brighton and Hove Albion. They have, over the years, been a bit of a bogey team for us. Go back to December earlier this year, at the end of last year, and Arsenal were 2-0 winners at the Emirates Stadium. A good, solid result there. But if you go back to last season, although we won at the Amex Stadium by 4-2 on the 9th of April, no, that's reading the wrong line. On the 31st of December, I was going to say, I remember it was New Year's Eve because my wife was furious with me. What I'd done in the build-up to New Year's Eve was say to a few people, "Come round mine on New Year's Eve. It'll be great." And then I got the call up to go and work at the Brighton game. So obviously I've rocked into the house at about, must have been about 11 p.m. And she's just fuming with me because I've invited these people round. You can't then uninvite them. She's had to like hold the fort down with the guests, but also with the kids. And there's me rocking in for the New Year celebration. And then that's it, not lifting a finger. But obviously, we were beaten by Brighton at the Emirates on the 14th of May, which was when our sort of title hopes were disappearing. Really, really disappointing result that. If you go back to Saturday, the 9th of April, 2022, when we were, of course, involved in a chase for the top four. We lost to Brighton then as well. And if you go back to Saturday, the 2nd of October, 2021, we were held to a 0-0 draw at the Amex. So in the last 5 meetings between these two sides in the Premier League, Arsenal have only won 2, Brighton have won 2, and there's been 1 draw. So this idea that we're just going to turn up and literally blow Brighton out of the water, I think, is a little bit fanciful. I think we do need to take this opponent very, very seriously. And I think they're a much better team under Roberto De Zerbi. They're a much more sophisticated team under Roberto De Zerbi than they ever were under Graham Potter. Is there a little bit of uncertainty at the football club at the moment because of some of the noises that Roberto De Zerbi's been making? I found it all a little bit strange. I understand that he probably thinks that, you know, Brighton is a bit of a stepping stone for him. If you've got massive ambitions as a manager, then Brighton isn't going to be your final destination, with all due respect to Brighton. I also understand, though, why he would be sort of wanting to question the strategy of the football club and the direction in which they're going, because for a long time it's been go out there, recruit really well, really effectively, bring people in through the door, utilize them, develop them, and then sell them on for a massive old profit. And the club have announced incredible profits just lately. But if you're a manager at some point, you're going to want that money to be reinvested back into your team. You're not going to want to go into every summer knowing that the likelihood is you're going to probably lose key players. You can't build like that. And I think that's why Roberto De Zerbi has asked the questions of the Brighton hierarchy as he has. Whether I'd have done it publicly, I'm not sure. But Roberto De Zerbi is quite a spiky character, and I think he believes in his own hype a little bit, and he's well within his rights to do so, and doesn't feel like that is going to hinder him in terms of A, whether Brighton want to keep him or not, or if somebody else is maybe looking at him. If we look at the form guide, Arsenal have won 4 of their last 5, just that one draw sandwiched in between wins over Brentford and Luton at the Etihad, a draw that Arsenal were massively criticised for, but a draw that I was very, very happy with. Brighton have only won 1 of their last 5, and that was a victory over Nottingham Forest down on the south coast. They've lost to Liverpool and they've lost to Fulham in recent weeks, and they've picked up draws against both Everton and Brentford. So Brighton don't come into this in the greatest form. There's been a lot of criticism, though, thrown Brighton's way this season, which I think is really unfair. They're currently 9th in the Premier League, and I think Brighton being in the top half of the table, given the size of the football club, is massive. It's massive. And people will say, well, yeah, but they keep selling X player and raising all these funds. But as we've just been talking about, they've not really reinvested that. You know, it has been profit, 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 profit. And I think that's reflected in their latest financial results. They've won 11 games this season, drawn 10, lost 9. On average, they score 1.7 goals per match. Arsenal averaging 2.4 at the minute. In terms of average goals conceded per match, Arsenal conceding on average less than 1. Brighton are conceding 1.5. They've only managed 5 clean sheets. Arsenal have got 13 under their belts so far this season. Top player stats, goals. Bukayo Saka leads the way in the Premier League. Will he play on Saturday? That's the decision that I think a lot of people are sweating on. He's got 13. Kai Havertz is in joint second with João Pedro on 8. João Pedro is a penalty taker, though, and I think that's blown his numbers up a little bit. On assists, Pascal Gross is the man who leads the way. He's got 10 for Brighton, a really, really important player to them. He is followed by Bukayo Saka on 8 and Martin Odegaard in 3rd on 6. If we take it over to tackles, Declan Rice leads the way. Again, I say it every week, Bukayo Saka being right up there probably surprises a lot of people, but he's in 3rd with 53. And sandwiched in between the two Arsenal boys is Pascal Gross. Again, highlighting his importance to this Brighton and Hove Albion side. What I want to do is have a quick look at the team that they picked against Brentford the other night. They had 24 shots at the G-Tech, 6 of which were on target. They had nearly 70% of the ball, but they couldn't win the game. And that would be really, really frustrating for Roberto De Zerbi. There's no doubt about that. If we go over to the BBC Sport website and have a quick peek at the team that they picked, as I say, the other night at Brentford, you're looking at that. And let me just zoom in on that a little bit. Here you go. So this was the team that they picked. Verbruggen was the keeper, Veltman, Van Hek, Dunk, and I think it's Igor Dos Santos de Paulo, that's his full name, was playing at left back. Gross and Baleba were in midfield. Buonanotte, Lallana and Adingra played in behind João Pedro. But Roberto De Zerbi is someone who loves to rotate. So it's really, really difficult to predict how his team are going to line up and how they're going to set up. If I look at the substitutes bench from the other night, I could make a case for Lamptey, Estupiñan, Welbeck probably, maybe even Enciso, maybe Steele coming back in goal. I could make a case for him making at least 5 changes. And that wouldn't be out of character for Roberto De Zerbi. As I say, they've got the most difficult lineups to predict because of the number of changes. I had done their game a few weeks ago at Fulham. And I remember turning up with my teams written out. And, you know, when you're reporting a game on the radio, you don't have a lot of time to process the team news before you need to go on air and explain it. You know, you might get it maybe 10 minutes earlier than everybody else, but it's still not a lot of time. And when it's two sides that you're not massively familiar with, like when I'm covering Arsenal, so the other night, the Arsenal team came out and it was like, that's 5 changes. And I know exactly who's gone out and I know exactly who's come in. When it's teams that you're not as familiar with, what I do is I write out the team from the previous game and then I cross off or tick the ones that are involved again. I cross off the ones that are not. And that's how I quickly work out how many changes there were. Brighton, I think, made six changes that day at Fulham. And that was a really, really difficult one for me to kind of process in the few minutes I had before I had to go on air and basically tell everybody listening what the team news was. So I know firsthand how unpredictable Roberto De Zerbi's lineups can be. And I think there are players on that bench that you look at and you think normally, or they're certainly good enough anyway, to start in that side. So we're going to have to see what it is that he goes with. But yeah, going to be fascinating. I'm going to talk about my Arsenal starting 11 in just a few moments. But first, I want to go over to the comments section, see what you guys are saying. Remember, if you haven't done so already, please do leave a like on the video. It really, really does help. Subscribe to the channel if you're brand spanking new. That helps as well. If you're listening on audio, reviews are very, very much appreciated. And if you're watching a clip from this or anything on TikTok or Instagram or whatever, make sure you come over and check out the full podcast. Let's see what you guys are saying. Big thank you to Derek for your kind words, mate. Thank you so much. What else have we got? James Bond. I don't think it's quite 007, but James says, I've never called for Arteta to be sacked. Next season, though, he must win a major trophy. Well, there obviously comes a point where the progress has to come to a head, where there is something that you can crown the progress off with. I said for a good 2-3 years now that progress was at the top of the list in terms of what I wanted to see, because I also recognize how bloody difficult it is to win some of these major trophies. You're competing against the Liverpool side that have been, you know, at the top of their game for a long, long time under a very experienced manager who's been able to get his feet underneath the desk and build what he wants to build. I look at next season and I think, well, it's very unlikely that whoever replaces Jurgen Klopp is going to hit the same heights as Jurgen Klopp in the very early stages of his career. So you feel like that would be them out of the way. But you're still up against Man City, who I wouldn't rule out of winning the Premier League, by the way. I know people seem to have written them off already. I'm not writing them off. Certainly not writing them off. You look at the resource they have, the experience they have, the depth they have, the manager they have. It's very, very difficult to come out on top against them. Liverpool, for all their might, for all their greatness over the last few years, for all the things they've achieved, Champions League victories, 97 points, 98 points, whatever. They've only won the league once. That's how difficult it is to do. But I agree that there will come a point where you're going to look at this project and you're going to go, well, we kind of have to get over the line to crown it all off. Otherwise, you know, what was the point? What I would say is, though, don't get obsessed with what's going to happen down the line. Don't get obsessed with, you know, when the trophy comes. I think it's really, really important as fans that we enjoy the ride and we enjoy the journey as much as is possible. Because, of course, there will be highs that you're going to be buzzing from. And there will be lows that leave you feeling down in the dumps. That's the nature of our game. That's why it's so such an emotional sport and a sport that everybody loves. But enjoy the... like, we all want to get to the same destination, but don't forget to enjoy the journey is the point I'm trying to make. Rob says, down to the seaside tomorrow. Me too. Hoping to go down nice and early. Might have some fish and chips down by the coast. That'd be nice before heading to the game. What else have we got? Derek says, maybe we can win all our games, but we are reliant on others to lose. Yeah, and it's not in our hands, is it? Which makes it difficult. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Siva says, the last two years, Brighton have ruined our running. 2022 knocked us out of the top four race, and we all remember last year. Confident we will get over the line this year, but it is a big game. Yeah, of course. James says, run up the likes. Yes, please, please do. What else have we got? Afsar says, Havertz is two yellow cards away from suspension. Therefore, will that affect his performance? This is so strange to me. And this is not aimed at you, Afsar. This is a general comment. When Kai Havertz got booked the other night for diving, which is unacceptable, by the way, like he shouldn't be going down from that challenge. Like, he's obviously trying to con the referee into giving him a free kick. And I have to say, even as an Arsenal man, I didn't like that. Okay. Let's be honest and upfront about it. But the reaction to him getting that yellow card was so disproportionate to what the actual situation is. He's two yellow cards. He's not one yellow card away. But everybody's going mad about it. Is this a problem? The point I'm trying to make here is this a problem that we need to focus on now? I don't want it to be a thing. I want Kai Havertz to play Kai Havertz's game. And if that means picking up yellow cards because he makes tackles high up and makes tactical fouls, which he does, or he puts himself about and sometimes he's a little bit late to the challenge, so be it. That's what Kai Havertz's game is. I'm not fussed about that. And I'm not worried about that. I think that's something that we should be worrying about as and when it happens. And then we can focus on how we're going to replace him then. Gabriel Jesus is more than capable of coming into that forward position and bringing us loads. It's a different threat, but he's still more than capable. People seem to forget what a huge part he played in elevating Arsenal from top four contenders to title contenders. And I don't think that should be forgotten. Just quickly before I share with you guys my starting 11 for the game against Brighton, don't forget to make sure that you are leaving a like on the video if you're watching us. If you're listening on audio, leave us a review. Give me a follow on X at Harry Simeu, on Insta at Harry_Simeu. Follow me on TikTok as well at Harry Simeu. Really, really appreciate you guys' brilliant support. Okay, let's turn our attention to the starting 11. What starting 11 would you pick? Let me know in the comments. Okay, so my 11 to face Brighton and Hove Albion at the Amex Stadium tomorrow evening is as follows. Let me share the screen with you guys. So I'm going with this. Hold on. How can I share it so it's like visible and all that? Here we go. So I would go with David Raya in goal. I'd bring Kivior back into the back line along with Gabriel, Saliba and White. My midfield would be made up of Thomas Partey, Declan Rice and Martin Odegaard. And my front three, because I'm pretty confident that that Bukayo Saka is going to be fit and available, consists of the England man from the right, Martinelli from the left, and Kai Havertz through the middle. That's the team that I would pick. I realize that there are going to be some disagreements to that in the live chat. I realize that there'll be some people that maybe say, why Kivior, not Tomiyasu, or why not Zinchenko? Personally, I'd still be quite cautious with Tomiyasu. And I think Kivior's done enough in recent weeks to deserve to continue playing and to come back into the side after being taken out, of course, on Wednesday night. When we move into the midfield, the Partey, Rice, Odegaard trio is what I've been calling the Holy Trinity all season. It's what I've been desperate to see. And I'd like to see that utilised where possible. Partey was managed very, very carefully, I thought, the other night in terms of how many minutes he was given. Obviously, it was possible to do that because of the position that we were in at the time. I thought in the first half, he looked pretty good. But I thought in the second half, at the beginning of the second half, he just faded a little bit. He got nearly 70 minutes under his belt. I don't know if Arsenal will look at him and think, well, maybe, you know, given the quick turnaround, we don't push it and we don't risk it again. Or if they'll think, you know what, he's okay to start now, but obviously with a view to maybe Jorginho coming on a little bit later on in the game, or, you know, maybe dropping Havertz into midfield, depending on the game state, maybe Jesus coming into the forward line. Some people are saying that Emile Smith Rowe should start. Others saying that Jesus should start. Maybe, but my opinion is that this is the best lineup to go with for this particular game. I looked at what Zinchenko brought to the team the other night and I thought, yep, lots of on-the-ball stuff, which we know he's really, really good at. But with Partey in that deep position, I think the need for Zinchenko is less. And with Rice and Partey providing that sort of core in the middle of the park, you get that defensive solidarity, but you also get the ball progression from deep from Thomas Partey, who I keep saying it, but I really do believe it, is as good at progressing the ball from deep as anybody that we have in this Arsenal side. We just haven't seen it all season because he's not been available. But that would be my starting 11 to face Brighton at the Amex tomorrow evening. Let me just run you through that one more time for those of you listening. Raya in goal, White, Saliba, Gabriel and Kivior across the back. Partey, Rice and Odegaard in midfield with Saka from the right, Martinelli from the left and Kai Havertz through the middle. So that means no place in the starting 11 for Gabriel Jesus, no place for Emile Smith Rowe, despite a good performance. He did look knackered at the end of that game, though. So I do wonder how much he's got in him just a few days later. But yeah, that's what I'm going with. Siva says, what have we got here? Rest Kai for a game. He's been at it nonstop, including the international break. Jesus should start and maybe keep Kai fresh for Bayern. I wouldn't be massively against that, but this is just what I would do. Charles says, I'd go with Raya, Zinchenko, Gabby, Saliba and White across the back. Rice, Odegaard and Partey, Martinelli, Jesus and Saka. I think he'll start Havertz from the bench this time around. So a few of you feeling like that could be the way to go and the way that Mikel Arteta might go. It's going to be interesting to see what he opts for in the end. Farid says, Harry, do you think Gabriel and Saliba are world class? Do you mean as individuals or as a combo? Because I think as a combo, it's undeniable now. I think they're the best central defensive pairing in European football at this moment in time. And if you're the best central defensive pairing in European football, then for me, you're the best central defensive pairing in world football. Therefore, you should be considered as world class. On an individual level, I think a lot of people look at William Saliba and think, maybe not quite there yet. And I'm talking about people outside of Arsenal circles. Maybe not quite there yet, but certainly on his way to being that. When it comes to Gabriel, I think he gets such a rough ride with the sort of wider football world. I just think that people struggle to see how influential and impactful and important he is to this Arsenal side. And it really, really bloody frustrates me because I think this season he's been better than William Saliba. That's not to say Saliba's been bad. You can't have that level of partnership if one of them is completely carrying the other. They've both been excellent. I just feel like last year it was clearly Saliba who had the bigger impact. This year for me, it's flipped the other way around. And I think Gabriel, who's probably at the peak of his powers right now, Saliba's not quite there. You know, he's still got a few more years to go. But I think the experience that Gabriel has picked up along the way and the way he's been able to turn that into learns and then use that to improve himself has just been amazing. It really, really has. I gave you a prediction for the Luton game. I said 2-0. I was spot on. I'm going to give you a prediction for this one as well. I'm going to go with Brighton and Hove Albion 1, Arsenal 3. And I'm going to give a couple of the goals to Bukayo Saka. That's what I dreamt about last night. So that's what I think I'm going to go with when it comes to my prediction. Let me know your thoughts in the live comments if you're watching us live. If you're watching this back later on, please let us know in the comments section below. If you've got any questions or anything that you want to get in, get them in as well, and we'll pick them up on the next show. Thank you all so, so much, as always, for tuning in. It is really, really appreciated because I don't know why anybody would want to sit on their Friday morning and watch me rambling on in front of a camera behind the microphone. But you guys keep turning up, keep listening, which I'm really, really grateful for. Obviously, I've gone to click something and click the wrong bloody button in the middle of my thank you speech. But anyway, thank you all so, so much. We've only got 70 likes on the board, though. If we can get that to over 100 before the live stream ends, I would be super grateful. You've been listening to the Chronicles of A Gooner, the Arsenal podcast, part of the 90 Min Football Network. Me, Harry Simeon. Hopefully, we'll be talking about Arsenal being top of the pile again on Saturday night. And then it'll be back over to Liverpool to try and wrestle that position back. I'll catch you all soon. Until the next one, goodbye.